With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Valentine's Day has rolled around again, and finding a potential mate may be on a lot of people's minds. But how do you go about finding a mate if you're stuck to the seabed like a coral? I'm Sarah Castor-Perry, and in this Naked Scientist special, I'll be finding out more about how corals have found a spectacular solution to this problem from someone who's actually seen it in action, James Guest from the National University of Singapore.
So I've witnessed multi-species coral spawning, or mass coral spawning as it's commonly known, on quite a few occasions now, mostly in Singapore, but also in the Philippines. And it's a pretty spectacular event. Typically, you only see it at night time. And just before the spawning, nothing is really happening. It's very quiet and there's no activity. And then suddenly, within a period of about half an hour, you'll start to see bundles of eggs and sperm. They're small bundles. They're a few millimeters across. They're often pink or red or orange. And they start to be released from many colonies at the same time, and also often many species at the same time. And the effect is something like a sort of a snowstorm in reverse, upside down, because the bundles are also buoyant. They contain lots of lipids, and they start to float to the surface. So you can imagine at nighttime, with all these brightly colored bundles all being released from many, many colonies at the same time, the effect is very spectacular. It's something like perhaps being in one of those snow globes, those little toys that children have. Towards the end of the spawning event, the bundles have all collected on the surface of the water. So when you surface, there's a big slick of coral eggs and sperm, and it's a bit like almost like an oil slick. And it's quite smelly. It has quite a strong smell. And so when you surface from the dive, you're actually get covered in all of these coral gametes.
So how many times in a year do we see the spawning?
Well, typically there is one major event. So there's a kind of a peak in spawning activity. In some parts of the world, it is around springtime. In Singapore, it is. It's in March, April. Often, actually, quite close to around the Easter weekend, we find we typically have the peak of spawning. However, there are other spawning events, and not all the corals go off at one time. Some individual species and some colonies will go off more than once in a year.
And how on earth do the corals manage to coordinate to make sure they all spawn at the same time?
Sure. No, I mean, it must be absolutely critical for them to spawn at the same time and within literally a few minutes of each other, because if they spawn more than an hour apart, the gametes from one, as you say, will have drifted away and fertilization won't happen. It's still a bit of a mystery exactly how they do it, but I mean, basically, it must be at two levels. So at one level, the corals must have some internal biological clocks that certainly run on a daily rhythm, so what we call circadian clocks, but they could also run on a lunar rhythm, so a circa-lunar clock. They may even run on an annual cycle, so a circa-annual clock. And we know quite a lot about circadian rhythms for a lot of other organisms, but we don't have much information about that for corals yet, although there is some research being done now. But then on another level, there's also the environmental cycles. So the internal clocks that the corals have must be sort of entrained by these environmental rhythms. So the environmental rhythms kind of keep the clocks in check. And there may be quite a number of different environmental factors that are involved at that, again, at different levels. So the day-night cycle is probably the one that we're most confident about, that it has a role, because corals tend to spawn usually not long after sunset, 1 or 2 hours after sunset. And we can actually manipulate that. It's quite easy to put a coral in the dark a bit earlier or keep it in the light for a bit longer. And that typically, if you do that, that will affect their spawning time. So So that's the one factor that experimentally we have some idea about. Unfortunately, the other factors are very difficult to experiment with. So we still don't have a good handle on how temperature and sunlight and lunar cycles and so on actually affect coral spawning patterns.
Okay, so once they've spawned and you've got all the gametes floating around in the sea, what happens next? They meet and they fertilise and they create a new coral. How does that happen? What happens after they've all released all their gametes?
So a lot of the coral eggs are buoyant, so they float to the surface. They bring the sperm with them bundled up in these little packets. And after a short period of time, the bundles break apart. And the sperm from one colony will try to find eggs from another colony, and fertilization happens right there in the water column. And usually, relatively quickly, they can fertilize. Fertilization can happen within minutes of bundle release. And we found certainly in experiments that within an hour, if you have coral gametes in tanks, you have almost 100% fertilization. So it all happens quite rapidly, and it is probably very important that it happens rapidly because there's all sorts of predators out there that want to eat the eggs and so on. Once fertilization happens, an embryo will start to develop, and by the next day, well, actually after about 24 hours, what you'll have is something that's starting to look close to being a larvae. It will be a little round ball. And then after about another 24 hours or so, you'll have a kind of cigar-shaped thing called a planular larvae. Then they'll spend quite a number of days in the water column as larvae. Basically, what will happen is they'll start to sort of use up the resources that were provided in the egg. So what they'll need to do is find a good piece of hard substrate somewhere on a reef at around the right depth in the right conditions. And then what they'll do is they'll detect chemical cues on the substrate, and the chemical cues are usually associated with the type of algae. And once they've detected those, they'll metamorphose, and so they'll change from being a planular larvae to becoming a polyp. And the polyp has a mouth, and it has a gut, and it has tentacles surrounding the mouth. Slowly over time, they'll begin to become a coral colony. But throughout that whole process, there's many, many gauntlets that they have to run, and they have to avoid predation. They have to avoid just sort of being washed away and not finding a piece of reef. As soon as they settle on the reef, they could be overgrown by algae. They could be scraped off by a grazing fish. They could be covered in sediment, and there's all sorts of things that they have to face. So very, very few of the eggs that are released actually survive to settlement, and then very few of those survive to become adults. On top of all the natural challenges that they face, there's the addition of the sort of human impacts that almost all coral reefs around the world now are feeling. I mean, aside from climate change, many reefs are experiencing very high sediment levels because of land reclamation, coastal development, and so on. So excess sediment sort of falling on top of a small coral polyp can very, very quickly smother it. And, of course, because they contain symbiotic algae, they need light to photosynthesize and survive. So if they get smothered by sediment very quickly, they won't be able to photosynthesize, and they're going to have problems. Another problem is overfishing. So many reefs around the world have lost the big herbivorous fish, which do the job of cleaning a lot of the algae off the reef, the sort of fleshy algae, the seaweeds and so on. And again, when coral spat have to sort of compete for space with algae, often the coral spat won't do as well, and so that's a big challenge for them. And then added on top of that, there's the bigger problem of climate change. There's not really much known or really anything known about how climate change is affecting the processes of coral reproduction and the process of post-settlement mortality in corals. We know quite a lot about how it affects adult corals. And, of course, it's having a big effect because we're getting these anomalously warm years, and we're having seeing lots of corals that are bleaching. That's when they lose their symbiotic algae, and if they don't recover them relatively quickly, they tend to die. And of course, the effect then is that those corals are no longer there. They're not going to be adding new progeny to the future generations. That the few corals that are left, they're not going to have so many individuals that they can mate with. And so if you, you know, when we go back to what we talked about earlier about these mass spawning events, I suppose the critical thing for those mass spawning events to be successful is to have lots and lots of individuals all spawning at once. But if the sort of critical mass of corals has suddenly dropped drastically, as you can imagine, the chance of successful reproduction is going to become much lower.
Because of the overproduction of gametes by the corals to buffer against things like predation, we could use the mass spawning to seed or repair damaged reefs. So either moving the collected spawn to new places or taking them back to the lab to rear them and then releasing them out into the field. How would that work?
Well, I mean, this is something potentially exciting, and this is some research that we've been focusing on for the last few years. So there's a couple of ways that this could be done. One way is to sort of harvest mass spawn slicks, just take billions and billions of embryos, and exactly as you said, is just to pump them down onto a bit of reef, maybe within some sort of enclosure, and try to just massively boost the amount of recruitment. The other way is, again, as you say, we could rear them in the lab so that we try to sort of overcome all those mortality bottleneck that you experience in the sea, and then settle them in a tank on land, let the corals grow up to a size where they've got a good chance of surviving, and then place them back on the reef. So the first method, we've done some experiments with that, and although it works in the sense that we can boost recruitment. What we found is that if you look at 6 months or 1 year down the line, the reefs that we have artificially seeded don't look any different from the reefs that have not had any seeding. And I think it's just because the levels of post-settlement mortality are so high that almost all of the corals that we seed onto the reefs are dying, and they just look the same as the reefs that we didn't do anything to. So at the moment, that particular method doesn't look like it will be very successful. The other method of rearing the corals in the lab for a period of time potentially has some promise, and we've had a bit of success with that in designing some little substrates that are cheap and easy to make, and we can settle corals onto them, we can rear them in tanks for a while, and then we can also rear them in a nursery in the sea for a period of time, and then eventually we can plant them onto the reef. And we've had some success with the technique. The main problem with it is it's actually very expensive to do. So just because of all the labor costs and so on and the time involved, even in a very optimistic scenario, it works out to be several dollars per coral. So we're talking about maybe like a two-year-old coral. It's going to cost at least $5 in a very optimistic scenario. Now, if you imagine trying to scale that up to square kilometers of reef, the cost of this restoration activity would be absolutely phenomenal. And so really, I mean, if you had that kind of money to spend, you'd think that it might be much better to spend it on management initiatives, on protecting an area, perhaps funding a patrol boat, a ranger, and these kinds of things, you know, sort of methods that we know are more likely to be effective, at least at this stage. I mean, I think we need to do more research on these restoration techniques, and it may be in the future that they can have some really good uses, and there's some pretty exciting stuff that can be done. I think whatever happens, you know, restoration is never going to be the only solution. We have to manage reef ecosystems effectively from the point of view of managing fisheries sensibly, coastal development, aquaculture development, and, you know, ultimately at the big scale, managing climate change. I mean, that's, of course, a really difficult thing to do because it has to be done at a international level and a community level and so on. But yeah, I think we have to remain optimistic, and we have to keep sort of pushing the message that reefs are really important, that they're threatened. But there have been some really good examples of reefs that, you know, when they are well managed, they recover very well from disturbances.
That was James Guest from the National University of Singapore talking to me, Sarah Castor-Perry, about the incredible spectacle of coral spawning. A shorter version of this interview is also included in the latest Naked Oceans podcast, Sex in the Sea, where we're looking at the weird and wonderful way marine creatures manage to find themselves a mate. If you'd like to have a listen and find out lots more about the wonders of the underwater realm, check out thenakedscientist.com/oceans. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.